was the sound of protesters advocating for justice after police officers had killed several unarmed African Americans in cities across the country. Good day and welcome to Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, your host, and as always, thanks for tuning in. Those protesters that you heard first took to the streets in Minneapolis after a man named George Floyd was brutally and openly murdered there by a police officer. We've all seen the footage of that officer with his knee on George Floyd's neck until the breath was squeezed out of his lungs. Amazingly, though, the protests did not stop after Floyd's death. They picked up and amassed millions in what became the biggest social movement our country has ever seen. People of all colors and backgrounds were walking the streets for months, demanding change and hoping for greater equality, for racial justice, and for an end to police wantonly killing innocent African Americans. But that's more than 2 years ago now, and I think it's fair to ask, what came of all this? Certainly we are having different conversations now about inequality and racism than we were before that point. And there are some places where there's real experimentation taking place about how to change policing or whether to have policing in the form that we all know it at all. But I think there's still a question about what we should make of the life of George Floyd, the man who became a symbol of that movement. His face and name have literally become recognizable everywhere in the world. People all over the place, of course, know exactly who that is and why he's important. But have we changed very much in America about the dangers that African Americans and many others face at the hands of the police? Later in the program, we're going to talk about what the consequences of those summer protests were here in Detroit. If you'll remember, Detroit was a central place for those kind of protests. We had lots and lots of people involved, and it went on for a long time. We're going to talk with WDET's Eli Newman about how Detroit's police department has changed and how it hasn't 2 years later. But before we get there, we do want to talk about what came of the life of George Floyd. What was his life trajectory? What were his challenges? And how were those things reflective of policies and practices that now have come into laser focus in America? Two writers at the Washington Post set out to understand all that. Robert Samuels and Tolu Oloronipa dug into George Floyd's life and tried to understand the complete context in which he lived and grew up. Importantly, they tried to understand not just his life, but the history into which he was born, the lives that came before him, but of course had deep, deep influence over him. They wrote a book about what they found, and it's called His Name is George Floyd, and I'm really pleased to welcome them here to talk about what they uncovered. Robert Samuels and Tolu Oloronipa, welcome to Detroit Today.
Thanks for having us. I really appreciate it.
So, yeah, it's so great to be with you.
Yeah, it's great to have you both here. I want to start with the idea of why it's important to know more about George Floyd than we could glean from the video of him being killed in Minneapolis, from the trial of the police officer who did it, from all of the things that came after his death. Why is it important to know who George Floyd is and where he came from? Robert Samuels, I'll start with you.
We started this project at a time when people didn't fully understand how the theory of systemic racism worked. We understood that people knew that when they saw Derek Chauvin kneel on George Floyd's neck, they saw something that was horrifying and on its face seemed unfair. But what we wanted readers to understand, and why we decided that this book would be a worthwhile project for the world, is that if you are concerned with the racism that revealed itself when Derek Chauvin murdered George Floyd, you should also consider the structures of racism that were consistently there in George Floyd's life before he had ever met Derek Chauvin. Because there are millions of people, untold numbers of people, Black people in this country who are still living in those conditions. And we wanted to be able to help show that if we understand who George Floyd is, we could help understand who we are as a society and continue working to dismantle some of those challenges that ultimately derailed his life. Mm.
So, Tolu Olorunipa, talk to us about who George Floyd was, where he grew up, what his family was like, what were the schools that he attended in the community he lived in, how did this set him up, I guess, for the life that he had in America, and of course, the death that he suffered at the hands of that Minneapolis police officer.
That's such an important question, and what we tried to do in this book was show that George Floyd was an American. He had a normal American experience in terms of wanting to have these dreams and believing that the American promise opened doors to all kinds of opportunities. He grew up in the South. He was born in North Carolina, and his family moved to Houston in the Third Ward as he was a young boy. And he had, you know, a normal childhood in the sense that he wanted to, you know, be something. He had dreams. We talked to a second grade teacher, and we saw the essay that he wrote when he was in second grade about wanting to be a Supreme Court justice. And his teacher remembered him as a student who was bright and who was reading and doing math at grade level. Now, that obscures the fact that, you know, he was born into deep poverty. He had these dreams. He had these ambitions. He had the hope of escaping that poverty. But his entire family history is marked by a deep kind of poverty that comes from discrimination. And we delved back into his family several generations and saw that his great-great-grandfather had been born enslaved, but worked really hard and actually had attained a massive level of wealth in North Carolina, only about 500 acres of land. But he had all of that land stripped away from him due to racism and discrimination in the late 1800s. And as a result, several generations after that, including the generation including George Floyd, were marked by deep poverty, hard work, without being able to reap the labor of that hard work, sharecropping and other kinds of domestic work and other kinds of work that did not allow them to establish themselves in any kind of generational wealth. So George Floyd was born into that. He was born, in the words of his mother, with two strikes against him already as being Black and poor. But despite that, he was someone who was always optimistic. He had dreams. He was someone who would go into a room and tell people, "I love you," because he did not want people to see his size and be intimidated by them. And unfortunately, he saw a lot of those dreams deferred. And we go into the book how, you know, he wanted to be a Supreme Court justice, and he wanted to be an athlete, and he wanted to be a rapper. And all of those dreams were essentially deferred as he ran into a number of hurdles that were placed in his path, from, you know, discrimination in housing to discrimination and segregation in the schooling system to the criminal justice system, which was also stacked against him. And it was important for us to show how he tried to navigate these various systems, including the mistakes that he made, including the times where the system was unfair to him, and how his experience was an American experience, but it's an experience of a different kind of America than what many people know. And it was one that was marked by systemic racism on a number of different fronts.
Mm-hmm. So Robert Samuels, one of the things that I think is really just hits you across the face about the stories in this book, the information in this book, is the contrast that it strikes with some of the narrative about George Floyd that we heard after he was killed. And this is pretty common, of course, when somebody has a run-in with a police officer and loses their life, the story becomes about why that person essentially may have deserved what they got. And maybe that's an oversimplification of the way that those stories are told, but certainly there is this culpability that gets assigned to victims like George Floyd because they're black, because they're poor, that says that they are less than in a way that justifies what happened to them. I want you to just for a minute focus on how stark, again, that contrast is from the truth of George Floyd's life and how that story is so common in America for other African Americans.
Absolutely. And it really goes to peel back to the idea of how we try to fulfill stereotypes and affirm our biases in this country. You know, Stephen, when we started reporting this book and we started talking about it, people would say to us, why learn about George Floyd? He was no saint. He was a drug addict. He had these issues. He had an arrest record. And it is true that, yes, George Floyd had a drug dependency issue. But the question is not really whether he did or he didn't. The question is why. And the question for readers and people who are intaking this information is what you draw from it, right? Now, when we did our reporting and we looked at the fact that he spent more than a third of his life behind bars, we also looked at the type of things he was arrested for. Sometimes he'd be detained for doing something as simply like walking down the street with nothing to do, looking like he was going nowhere. That was the police explanation for it. We spoke to people who were victims. You know, one of the cases that's most known is that he had pleaded guilty to an armed robbery charge. On the internet, they talk about it as him holding up a pregnant woman with putting a gun to her stomach, right? But when we spoke to the woman, that reporting was done by one of her colleagues at the Post, Elise Hernandez, who spoke to her in Spanish, which there's no documentation that the police did. Spanish was her first language when she wasn't pregnant. Two, she said the person who held the gun to her stomach was 5'6". George Floyd was 6'6". And when she identified him in a lineup, a list of photos, she circled him and they asked, are you sure? Are you positive? Are you completely unsure? Are you tentative? She chose tentative, which is way below the reasonable standard, sure, doubt standard in the United States. So why did George Floyd plead guilty to that, right? You have to look at the context of his neighborhood. The belief that if you get caught with a charge, no matter your innocence, there was no public defender system to help you. George Floyd never went to trial for anything that he was charged with or convicted of doing because there was no public defender system in Texas. He was also a big man and he understood the stereotypes that come with having his size and being black and poor in America. And often the best choice in his community was believed to accept a plea deal because the consequences, no one would believe you anyway. And the consequences, if you didn't accept the plea deal, would be dire. So take the time and go back to your family. That's the kind of world he was living in. But what we really want your listeners to understand here is this is not a distinct world. It is something that is endemic in the United States today, even still. And that we raise these stereotypes and we talk about people in these ways who are Black, often in a way that discounts them. But when we think about people who go through the same sort of struggles and how that's translated when they're white in America, you know, think about all the American legends that are based on the tragedies and the persistence of people in this country who got knocked down and tried to pick themselves up. what our reporting showed through more than 400 interviews with people who had known George Floyd best was every time George Floyd was knocked down, he followed in that same American legend of trying to pick himself back up. He was fundamentally an American man.
I'm talking with Robert Samuels and Tolu Olorunipa. They are reporters for The Washington Post who've published a book called His Name is George Floyd, One Man's Life and the Struggle for Racial Justice. We're talking about George Floyd, the man, and the life that he led before he was killed by a Minnesota police officer in 2020, an event that really did inspire much of the current movement that we are witnessing and in some cases participating in, that calls on America to rethink not just policing, but also the racial context in which policing is executed in our country. We want to hear from you during the conversation as well. What do you make of George Floyd's life? How did his murder and the subsequent protests change your understanding of our country? How do you see things like race and the criminal justice system now? Is it different because of what happened to George Floyd or what's happened in the subsequent incidences where we see innocent African Americans killed by police? How much do you think history and the communities we grow up in determine our lives, our relationships with institutions like the police department? As always, the number here on the phones is 313-577-1019. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to the WDET Facebook page, put comments there, or go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today, and we can work you into the conversation. Also, give us a call and let us know what you think of policing in our own communities here in Southeast Michigan. A little later in the program, we're going to talk with WDET's Eli Newman. He's a reporter and a producer here, about how Detroit's police department has changed and how it hasn't since George Floyd was murdered. We would love to hear from people about the interactions you have with police, not just in Detroit, but in the many suburbs around us. What do those look like? How do they feel if you are African American, if you are somebody who doesn't have a lot of money? Do you feel as though the police are there for you, or are the police there as a force kind of against you? Again, 313-577-1019 is the number on the phones. You can go to Facebook and Twitter, the comments there, and we can work you into the conversation. Before we get to listeners, Tolu, I want to talk about something that comes up in the book. It's called The Minnesota Paradox, the idea that Minnesota is and was sometimes a racially progressive state and other times not so much. I think that's another powerful theme that doesn't just apply to Minnesota, but applies to lots of parts of American life. Talk about the Minnesota paradox.
Yeah, George Floyd moved from Houston, his hometown, to Minneapolis in 2017. And being part of this progression of people from his hometown in Houston who saw Minnesota as a state of opportunity. They moved up north as their ancestors had, as other Black Americans had earlier in American history as part of this great migration, because the Midwest and the North provided new opportunities, more equality. And that, in some ways, is the draw that led George Floyd to move to Minnesota. But as he got there, he realized, as many other Americans do, that it's not a paradise. It's not a place that does not have its own, you know, fraught racial history and fraught racial disparities. And we see that in Minnesota, even though it has a number of progressive policies, even though on the surface level they support a number of things that provide for equality across the races, and there's not that blatant racism that you often see in the South, there are still very stark disparities when it comes to different communities. There's still high levels of segregation when it comes to residential policy, and there are still policies that are put forward, even though they're not racist on their face, that have you know, racially disparate impacts, and that is seen in housing, it's seen in education, it's seen in the wealth disparity that we see. And for George Floyd, it came across as, you know, he was able to, you know, stand on his feet in Minnesota, but unfortunately that only lasted for a certain amount of time. He wasn't able to outrun the systemic racism that he had experienced earlier in his life by changing his location. He still experienced those same levels, those same types of discrimination, and that same type of disparity when he got to Minneapolis. So that's part of the paradox that people who you know, travel there, or people who live there, experience both the positive sides of being in a progressive state, but also the veneer that sometimes that progressivism cannot shield them from, you know, the racism that is a part of our country and that is a part of our history as well.
Mm. And even so, the consequence for Derek Chauvin, which was, I mean, itself an outlier in the narrative about police killings of African Americans in this country, is only possible because of a certain progressivism. Keith Ellison, who's a native Detroiter, who's also the Attorney General of Minnesota, decides that there will be real consequences for Derek Chauvin. He prosecutes him for murder and gets a conviction. That is also, I think, sort of, I mean, it's not just a notable part of the story. I think it's a critical part of this idea of how all this kind of fits in the context of this problem in America, that here, because it's in Minnesota, we get some semblance of justice out of it. Talu, can you talk just a little about that consequence and how that fits into the story?
Totally. And what we saw from Minneapolis in terms of kicking off the protest that ended up going nationwide and internationally, we saw a diverse group of people coming out to protest for George Floyd, to protest for his humanity. And that is part of that progressivism, part of the fact that you have people who live in Minnesota and who live in the Midwest who are willing to, you know, embrace this idea of equality, embrace the idea that the police should not be snuffing out a life like they did in the case of George Floyd. And we saw that move forward with the prosecution, you know, Derek Chauvin being prosecuted and charged with second-degree murder. Often in these police cases, you know, the charges are never filed, or if they're filed, they're filed at a very low level. But, you know, Keith Ellison and his team, as we report in the book, decided that they were going to go strongly at this case, and they're going to try to make the strong case that Derek Chauvin wantonly took George Floyd's life without regard for his humanity. And they made that case before a jury of Derek Chauvin's peers right there in Minneapolis, and he was convicted and sentenced. And even today, there's going to be another sentencing of another one of the officers who pled guilty for being a part of that process. And that's a sign that, you know, Minneapolis was key to what we've seen over the past couple of years, in which, you know, prosecuting police officers is no longer this, you know, far-fetched idea in which it hardly ever happens. Derek Chauvin is actually just one of a handful of police officers who have ever been convicted of murdering someone in the city of Minneapolis. But it is a change. It is something that has happened in part because of George Floyd's murder, yeah, and in part because of the city in which it happened and the region in which it happened, in which, you know, these kinds of things cannot be swept under the rug anymore.
Yeah.
If I could jump in here, because I think, sure, this is really important.
Go ahead.
Keith Ellison, who's the state attorney general, wasn't originally assigned to prosecute the case.
Right.
The governor,
he had to take it.
Yeah. The governor of Minnesota asked him to do it because he thought he might have a better shot because of his experience and because of his knowledge of what can happen in the legal system as a Black man. And what that legal team did was they had to unthink some of the ways they typically try to prosecute police officers. The only officer in Minnesota that had ever been charged with killing someone on the job was a Black man who killed a white woman. So they didn't have a lot of statistics. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that they needed to reconsider was, who is the medical examiner? Is the medical examiner in cahoots with the police department? how much do we need to go outside of the traditional systems and barriers to make sure that justice could be had for George Floyd and Derek Chauvin could be held accountable. There were extraneous measures that needed to be taken, including downplaying the testimony of their own witness, the medical examiner for the county, if they needed to do it, because the biases that that persist within the legal system were still present in Minnesota.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, we need to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to continue this really interesting conversation about his name is George Floyd, one man's life, and the struggle for racial justice. Also, just talking about policing and racism in America. Let's get going on the phones when we get back as well. 313-577-1019 is the number. Call and tell us what you make of George Floyd and his murder 2 years after it happened, 2 years after massive protests launched a worldwide movement to reconsider policing, to reconsider racism and its history in America. Again, you can also go to Facebook and Twitter, put comments there, and we'll work you into the conversation. We'll be right back with more Detroit Today.
Bringing you news that matters.
Stories that impact your life.
Music from the Motor City and around the world.
This is 101.9 WDET,
Detroit's NPR station.
This is Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson. And as always, thanks for tuning in. We are talking right now to Tolu Olorunipa and Robert Samuels, two reporters from The Washington Post, who published a book called His Name is George Floyd, One Man's Life and the Struggle for Racial Justice. We're talking about policing and the way that George Floyd's murder changed the way that a lot of us see policing, changed the way that a lot of us are talking about racism and the history of inequality in America. We want to hear from you during the conversation as well. Give us a call on the phones. Talk about what is different in your mind about the way you think about policing because of the death of George Floyd. What's changed in the last 2 years? What would you hope would change that maybe hasn't yet happened over the last 2 years? Also give us a call and let us know about your experiences with police here in Southeast Michigan, the Detroit Police Department, which we're going to talk about in a little bit with WDET's Eli Newman, but also lots of suburban police departments that people interact with. Are you seeing things differently when you interact with those police? Are you seeing them behave differently when they interact with you? Again, 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Facebook and Twitter, put comments there, and we'll work you into the conversation. Guys, before we get to listeners, I also want to talk about how you followed Derek Chauvin's life in the book, The Police Officer Who Killed George Floyd. Talk about the institutions and communities that produce him and how they are, I guess, somewhat similar, somewhat different from the circumstances that that produce George Floyd. Robert Samuels, I'll start with you here.
Sure. Well, Derek Chauvin's family immigrated to the United States on their own accord. And even though they did not grow up with, they did not come here with much, they were able to, over generations, build a middle-class lifestyle, including a history in Detroit, where one of Derek Chauvin's forebears had a bookbinding business on the river. What we learned about Derek Chauvin was that he was a largely unremarkable student. We tried to speak with more than 100 people who had interacted with him in his life. And he loved watching Starsky and Hutch and became eventually joined the army, which he found a purpose and he wanted to become a police officer. Now, what we don't talk a lot about what was going on in Derek Chauvin's head, but because we don't know. But what we do know is that he joined a police precinct in a diverse community that was known as the Thumpers. They were known for using aggressive force. And Derek Chauvin followed in that model. He was known particularly for using neck restraints. That's choking, in layman's terms, in the most simplest of terms. Over the course of his 19-year career in the police department, we found that he starts using the neck restraint 18 days after he's trained on it. And in he often tells people he used it because the person was bigger than him. Derek Chauvin was only 5'9". And so what we see throughout his career are people complaining about his aggression, his use of force, complaining to the police department. But because the systems are so labyrinthine, he's never reprimanded for it in a documented way. So sometimes there's this rumor that Derek Chauvin and George Floyd had known each other because they had worked in the same club. And it's true that at some point they might have been working at the same club. No one ever knows if they did it at the same time, but there's no reason to believe that Derek Chauvin did this because it was something personal. Hmm. What the reporting showed was Derek Chauvin used this technique often with increasing aggression as time went on and continued to use it despite complaints that were coming from the public.
Yeah. Again, 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. Let's start today with Brian in Detroit. Brian, what's on your mind?
I was just listening to the podcast. It was just profound because I'm 51 and I was raised in born in Detroit. And my parents were biracial. My dad was black. My mom was white. They talked about the racism of cops, which back then was probably predominantly white. And then, I myself have experienced it just over minor civil infractions. You get dogged, you get hounded. Then you get one ticket, they are always on you no matter what, even before those tickets expire within 3 years. It's a bad situation. It calls for reform and we're not willing to do it.
So Brian, before I get back to our guests, when you say reform, what in your mind would that look like? What should change about policing?
One is we've known for the last 30 years, I would say, that the police and the military, and which are an interchangeable organization, they need to be reformed for one thing. The first thing is primarily get the white ideologues of white supremacy out of those organizations. That's been documented more than enough. Then after that, there needs to be comprehensive training for cops that they understand their civil enforcement of a civil society. They're not military. I those are my two important things.
Brian, I really appreciate the call and those ideas. Tolu Aloranipa, talk about how, this idea that Brian has that, that one interaction with a police officer can snowball, right? He says, they get you with one ticket and then they're all over you. Certainly that was made evident in George Floyd's life, but that is part of the American experience and especially the African-American experience with police.
Yeah, and I'm so glad that Brian brought up those points because in the book we get into the fact that George Floyd experienced policing in a different way than most Americans. He lived in a community where police were always there and they were always looking to make low-level infractions, civil infractions, stop people for seemingly no reason. He was stopped more than 20 times, and we documented at least about six of the officers who stopped him were later charged with abusing power. And in some of the cases that he was arrested for things as simple as walking through his own neighborhood because the police said in their report that he didn't look like he was going anywhere in particular. And they stopped him and they arrested him. And he knew that, as a result of his skin color, as a result of where he lived, as a result of the fact that the war on drugs and the mass incarceration was happening, that he was going to be targeted for some of these you know, petty arrests, often for not doing anything, you know, particularly damaging, but just for being in the wrong place at the wrong time, because the police didn't want people hanging out on the corner. They'd run up and they would arrest whole groups of people. And that has an impact on your life. It's not just an inconvenience. George Floyd was unable to get a job for a large portion of his life because he did have a record. And in a state like Texas, if you have a record, you can't even apply for a number of professional licenses, like being a barber or being a locksmith. You couldn't get those kinds of licenses, and he couldn't work. And that leads to, you know, a lot of people going back into the thing that got them in the crosshairs of the criminal justice system in the first place. So it's really important what Brian mentioned about how, you know, what may seem like just an inconvenience, you know, getting targeted or getting ticketed by the police can really have these longstanding impacts and longstanding effects on people. And we see that in George Floyd's life over the course of 2 decades in which he was cycling in and out of the criminal justice system. And it's part of the reason he moved to the Midwest, because he felt that in Texas, which was an incredibly punitive state, he would never get a fair shot, and he would always be in the crosshairs of police. And he left, and then tragically, he lost his life in Minneapolis under the knee of a police officer. But it was something that was a critical part of his life, even on the days where there were no people filming what was happening in his interactions with the cops.
Yeah. Okay. Tolu Olorunipa and Robert Samuels, congratulations on the book. It really is a riveting read, but especially thanks to both of you for being here to talk about it on Detroit Today.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you.
We're going to take another break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about how Detroit's police department has changed since the mass protests during the summer of 2020. Eli Newman, reporter and producer right here at WDET, is going to join us to discuss. Stay tuned for more Detroit Today.